You are listening to an American Free Press podcast.
Joining me on the line is Antonia Juhas, a leading oil and energy expert. Antonia, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me. Good afternoon.
Antonia, there's so much I want to talk about with your book that I just read, The Tyranny of Oil, and I mentioned before the interview I could spend several hours on it, and I certainly can. And I want to get into that in a moment, but before we do, for the benefit of the listeners, can you give them a little bit of background about who you are?
Sure. I'm an investigative journalist. I'm a fellow with the Investigative Reporting Program, which is a working newsroom at the University of California Graduate School of Journalism. And I focus on oil and energy issues. I've been writing books and articles for many years, working as a journalist, but also as an advocate, trying to address the myriad of ways that oil and energy impacts everything from human rights to public policy, the environment, our climate, and our world, and wrote The Tyranny of Oil in the lead up to 2008, so that it was very much in my mind to be part of the dialogue in the 2008 presidential election, given that oil had played such a prominent role in the presidency of George Bush and Dick Cheney.
Yeah, you know what, I was going to save this for later, but I may as well ask you now. That was written, like you said, in 2008, and on chapter 9, and this is page 370 of the book, and I think that's the last chapter, you say here that you're talking about a new spirit of populism being alive and well in the United States, and just a few months before, Senator Barack Obama declared that he would end both the tyranny of oil, and that's, of course, where you got the title of the book, right?
The way that I came upon the title was that when then-Senator Barack Obama became the first African-American to win a presidential primary when he went to Iowa, he gave a really important speech. It was very short, and it was important, the key issues that he focused on. And in that speech, he said in one breath, "I'll be the president that once and for all ends the tyranny of oil and ends the war in Iraq," directly linking those two issues, which I thought was quite profound. And he had definitely run in many ways along a populist line and certainly had taken a very hard line on issues related to oil, again, as a candidate. My book was an attempt to say, what are the many constraints that the oil industry puts on the American political system, all of which are very, very, very true today. The book is as true today as it was when I wrote it, and certainly provides a very important foundation on which to understand today's political issues, but also to understand the myriad of ways that those political constraints then impact the world, as well as the United States, in terms of all those ways I already named: our environment, our climate, wars, peace, politics, society, etc.
So as a candidate, obviously he got you fired up, right?
As a candidate, he got me excited about his position on oil and his position to end the war. I certainly didn't have a blanket acceptance of all of his positions, but I found those two positions certainly ones that I could get behind. And I was very excited to hear him use that sentence, which is why it became the title of my book. And I certainly was very desirous to not see a continuation of another 4 years of Republican policies that would have been carried out by John McCain and Sarah Palin if they had won the 2008 election. I found those policies heavily, heavily guided by the oil industry, and I think most of the American public did as well. I found them incredibly disastrous, and that there really was no option to see those policies continued for another 4 years. And I think we're continuing to see the ramifications of those policies, by the way, looking at the U.S. attempt to deal with issues in Syria and Egypt today. We just have absolutely no credibility on the global scene, and I think one of the primary reasons for that is the immense credibility that was lost as a result of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, which I also feel are tied to oil and the decisions of the oil industry. So that takes us into some different terrain. But again, it just emphasizes in my mind how critically important the role of the oil industry is and the myriad of ways that the U.S. government acts and the implications of those actions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all terrain is good here. And as far as Obama and his big words when he was running, and of course, there's a lot of people who are disappointed. Has he done anything positive to rein in oil?
He certainly has done some things. He certainly has not ended the tyranny of oil. The Bush administration was hands down the most oil-influenced administration in the history of the United States. The administration within which the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and those were just the three tip of the icebergs for dozens of people within the administration, all came out of the oil and energy sector, had a large experience within that sector. President Bush was only the second American president to have his work experience be the oil industry. The only other president before him was his father, George Bush Sr., and they really instituted an oil government where the oil industry could stop lobbying and just start legislating, and it did, and it got just about everything it wanted, a really open door policy to drill anywhere, explore anywhere, use the military to go after large pockets of oil, to protect large pockets of oil from other people who might be interested in it and other countries that might want it, to open up oils and tar sands and fracking and to remove regulations and restrictions and to go anywhere and go everywhere for oil. And that's what happened. The oil industry also grew tremendously in its wealth and power during those 8 years, amassing the largest fortune of any corporations in history. And they still continue on that trend today. And they have used that wealth to continue to constrain political decision making. So I think that one of the areas that the Obama administration came in to tackle was oil. And this certainly is not an oil government. The oil industry's money has gone to Republicans, as it always has. There are not oil representatives well represented within the administration. The sector that's most representative within the administration is the finance sector, which is intimately linked to the oil industry, but isn't one and the same. And I think when Obama came into office, he was more constrained by this industry than he would have liked. I also think he was deeply constrained by a Congress that is also deeply constrained by this industry and following this industry's interests. And I also think he wasn't intent on making the type of changes that people like myself would have wanted to see happen. And so a combination of his not going as far as we thought he would just because he didn't actually want to, and being constrained by the power of the industry, has kept him from doing both things I think he intended to set out to do and the things that many of us had hoped that he would do. And there have been changes. This is certainly an administration, for example, that believes in the human impact on climate change and the need to address that and to change government policy to address that. And it has the need to put in place regulations on sources of greenhouse gas emissions, on fuel efficiency for cars. These are all important things to actually try and negotiate climate change proposals. But it's also an administration that is deeply, deeply constrained in the choices that it has made and is making. And it has embraced this ridiculous concept of all of the above in terms of our energy consumption. So while it is definitely promoting alternative energy in ways that previous administrations have not, it is also allowing the largest increase in domestic oil production in many, 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 many years, certainly in fracking and offshore production. And those are all very problematic policies.
Is there a direct correlation, or would you know of a direct correlation between fracking and earthquakes?
Yeah, I think that's been well proven at this point. I actually don't think there's too much of a debate over it. When you loosen the stability of the soil around fault lines, also when you create natural quakes with the actions of the chemicals and the loosening of the soil and the completely restructuring of the geology in fracking sites, earthquakes have become common. And I think it's just a natural result of the method of production. It creates immense instability in the geology, and there's very little that can be done to reverse that once you've removed the dirt, removed the gas, infused water and chemicals, and completely changed the makeup of the ground. It's going to have many, many consequences. And it seems to me that the causing of earthquakes is clearly one of them.
Yeah, I'm shaking my head here. It brings a whole new meaning to destroying the earth. They're literally destroying the earth, and they're getting away with it, it seems. I don't understand. I mean, it's obvious what they're doing here. Like you said, they're mechanically shifting the contents of the earth. And of course, something's going to happen, but it doesn't seem to concern them. Can't figure it out.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it's just one example of the many ways that the production of oil and natural gas is deeply harmful to the environments around it and the people around it. And I assume that the rationale of the industry is that the benefits outweigh the costs, that they're getting a product out of the ground that is both useful and profitable, and that those are the benefits, and the costs associated with it are ones that we as a society have decided that at this point we're willing to pay. And it's really up to us to tell them that they actually can't do anything they want to get oil and gas, that we actually think there are other things that are more valuable than those products. Yeah. And that's really up to us to tell them.
Yeah, the costs of doing business, right? Now, How did you know that you wanted to study oil? When was it that you decided to become an expert in oil?
I had been working as a congressional aide on Capitol Hill, a legislative assistant, and had gone into working for the government with all the right reasons, wanting to create political change, and saw that there was a large constraint to our ability to do that. And that, to me, increasingly became clear to be the power of corporations over our ability to act in the public's interests. And I felt after a certain period of time that working for Congress wasn't the way to address those issues and that I needed to leave Congress and began addressing issues of corporate power in a variety of ways. And once I started focusing on corporations, it didn't take long to focus in on the oil industry, which was and is the most powerful industry, and increasingly focus my interest and my energy and my research and my investigations and my writing on that sector. And that has been the case ever since, going on 10 to 15 years. And The Tyranny of Oil is my second book, and I wrote it because I felt that there was a huge gap in public information on really understanding how this industry works today, how it got to where it is, what it does. And I felt that there really hadn't been a critical deep analysis of the industry since the 1970s with a really important book called The Seven Sisters. But since then, while there'd been very, very good books on the industry, there hadn't been anything quite to that depth and critique. So I set out to write that book, and that's what I think Tyranny of Oil does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it does. And thank you for writing it. And you are a wonderful writer.
Thanks.
You're not just giving the reader all the information that they need, all the historical information that they need, but you're doing it in a way that it's pleasant to read. And that's very rare. So thank you for writing it.
Thank you.
I enjoyed it very much. Now, let's get into Big Oil. On page 7, Big Oil, at least in 2008, I don't know if it's changed, I don't pay too close attention to the components of Big Oil, but it looks like ExxonMobil, Shell, BP, Chevron, ConocoPhillips, Valero, and Marathon. Is that still the same?
Some slight differences within there, but yes, still the same companies. There have been some really interesting changes in the industry where they've been, because oil has become so much more profitable for them, just the actual oil as opposed to gasoline. There's been this trend in the industry to break off its refining and distribution parts. So ConocoPhillips has now broken off its oil from its gasoline sector, and Phillips 66 is its production arm, and that's catapulted, making that company even more profitable than it was as the merged company, ConocoPhillips.
Big Oil was, as you say on page 46, really the first multinational corporation, right?
The most powerful for certain. John D. Rockefeller was the founder of Standard Oil, which quickly became the most powerful corporation, certainly in the United States and in the world. And Rockefeller is given all sorts of credit for things which I don't think he deserves. He didn't discover oil. He didn't discover the use of kerosene. He didn't discover the multinational corporation. He didn't discover the idea of the trust. He's just the person that took these ideas that other people had and I think was the most vicious in implementing and aggressive in implementing the, I guess, purity of the model and created this incredibly vicious, powerful corporate trust, Standard Oil, and really did everything he could to actually break up the people who were the inventors of different methods of pipelines and kerosene and production, and he broke them in half to create his giant. There's a really telling cartoon from the height of Standard's power. I think it was around 1880. And there's a political cartoon in a newspaper that I think many people would appreciate today. And it's a cartoon image of the U.S. Senate. And they're seated and towering above the Senate are these huge, obese, fat cats, men in top hat and tails representing the corporate trusts. But the only one that's represented by name is Standard Oil. And Standard Oil is towering over the Senate. And there's a sign above the Senate that says the U.S. Senate of the monopolist, by the monopolist, for the monopolist. And there's a teeny tiny corner under lock and chain is a door that reads People's Entrance. And so the view at the time was that Standard Oil was so powerful that it was inhibiting the ability of the Congress to do its work. But as a result of this, this was an era of mass political uprising. And there were strikes and protests. And there were people from all corners of the United States organizing for really dramatic political change, which they achieved. Enormous changes in labor laws, campaign laws, the very first restrictions on campaign finance, and antitrust law, the target of which was Standard Oil. And eventually, the power of Standard was directly tackled, including the work of a really important independent journalist, Ida Tarbell, who targeted Standard Oil in her work and really opened a huge window to the public's understanding of how the company worked and exposed an enormous amount of its crimes. And by 1911, all of this pressure made its way to the U.S. Supreme Court, which eventually broke Standard Oil up because it was too big to control into 34 separate corporate parts.
And that Tarbell article, that was almost 100 years ago, right?
Yeah, 100 years ago, she wrote a series in McClure magazine. She spent years on it, which is very, for investigative journalists today, the idea that you could have years and money and time and resources to right. just dig into one topic should help the public appreciate the significance of having journalists who are able to do that type of work. It was really her investigation that was the key information used by the government to break Standard up. And that's because she was a journalist who had the time and resources to be able to do such a project. And it was a huge change of events to have Standard broken up into these pieces. The problem is that the American public lost a lot of things over the course of that 100 years. One of the things we lost is the government's appreciation for the need for antitrust law and the need to keep companies in a way that we can control them and have a really functioning democracy. And particularly starting in the 1980s, antitrust law was really rejected. And the allowance of corporations to merge and form into mammoth beings was permitted. And what you saw in the oil sector over the course of 20 years, starting in the 80s, was the beginning of these mega mergers. And really, all the largest pieces of Standard Oil were allowed to merge back together. So the two largest post-breakup pieces were Standard of New York and Standard of New Jersey. Those two companies eventually became Mobil and Exxon, and they were then allowed to merge into one company, forming, not surprisingly, the largest corporation in the world, ExxonMobil. Other pieces that came together, Conoco and Phillips, which are now today's Phillips 66. Other oil companies that were permitted to merge, Chevron and Texaco and Gulf and Getty, which all became one company, which is Chevron. BP was allowed to buy Amoco and Arco. That's all BP. I think I've got just about everybody. But we saw just these mammoth mergers creating, once again, the world's handful of companies that are, once again, the world's most powerful oil companies.
And I wanted to comment about that cartoon. And I've seen that cartoon. It's great. You said that was from like the late 1880s, right?
Yeah.
Has anything changed?
Things changed and then they were allowed to come back together. So I think, you know, many people have commented that this period of history is very reminiscent of the Gilded Age. We've forgotten the lessons learned through history, which we did learn for a significant period of time. And we have allowed corporations to return to a position and the wealthy to return to a position where they have just condensed an enormous quantity of power and wealth into the hands of a few and disenfranchised the many. And hopefully we will also learn the lessons from that period, which is that public resistance and public change can actually change the course of history for many, 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 many decades. We just have to follow the model we've already done before.
Coming to almost the modern day, big oil, they produce, and you say this on page 132, approximately 13% of the world's oil, while OPEC produces about 40%. Are those numbers still accurate?
I'm not positive if those numbers are exactly the same, but they're going to be just about the same. The only shift really that's happened since then is the dramatic emergence onto the scene of the Chinese oil companies and the Russian oil companies. So you've got CNPC, Chinese largest company, Sinopec oil company, and Gazprom, Russia's largest oil company. Those companies have really started to enter themselves into the world of big oil in a way that we don't fully understand because they're such closed companies. It's very, 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 very difficult to get any information on them, but they certainly have entered into the fold of big oil. And so the numbers are going to be larger if you consider them part of the overview of big oil versus OPEC for certain, but it also lessens the amount of isolated power that the Western oil companies hold.
Let me just tell the listeners the reason that I had contacted you was because, and this is many years of watching the price of oil and going to the pump and thinking that, okay, it went down, I'm going to go get some gas and it's going to be cheaper. And of course, losing all those bets in my mind that literally, okay, hey, it went down, it's got to go down. And it would go up and vice versa. And of course, this made me very aggravated over the years. And that was the background about why I contacted you. But looking at today's prices at the pump, can we say that, and this, of course, I learned this from your book, but can we say that this was precipitated during the first few days of Ronald Reagan's presidency?
Deregulation of refineries and gas pricing certainly has had a dramatic impact that happened under the Reagan administration that started the trend, which we're now seeing. The consolidation that was begun within the Reagan administration is another large part of the trend. And basically, I would say the most significant things that happened within the Reagan administration was simply the mantra of deregulation and the lack of permitting rules and regulations and oversight to restrict the activity activities of this sector. And this trend of deregulation has had the largest impacts on pricing of gasoline and oil, consolidation within the industry, which also affects pricing of gasoline and oil, and the free hand that allows the industry to go wherever it wants to go. But the deregulation that began under Reagan also includes the shifting of the pricing of oil onto oil futures markets. And once that happened, among a lot of other changes, we really saw pricing shift out of oil, shift out of the hands of OPEC and into the hands of futures traders. And that may be one of the more significant of many changes that were begun under the Reagan administration.
Right. But it did start with me now, didn't it? Actually, I could do much better, Ronald Reagan, but not today. Go ahead. So Reagan, whether or not he even knew what that meant, I'm not convinced if he even understands what deregulation has meant at the time he was living, if he understood what it meant, because there's so many reports of the guy actually sleeping at meetings, through meetings. But here you talked about the futures and taking it out of the hands of government regulations. Great move, guys. But let the listeners know, what exactly is a futures contract?
A futures contract is a commitment to buy a good in the future for a price set in the present. But the use of futures contracts really isn't about physical products. It's about money. So if you think of exchanges on which futures are made, the New York Mercantile Exchange and the International Continental Exchange are the two largest. Futures are traded there in a very similar way to stocks being traded in other markets. It's the movement of promissory notes, really, more than anything else, that bankers and oil companies and hedge funds are betting on the direction and which way the prices will go to make money off of the trade of the slip of paper that says which direction things are going to go. It's really just a way of betting on money. It's not really an actual willingness to exchange a good at the end of the day. But the trading in oil futures was premised on the idea of a trade in the good of oil or the trade in the good of gasoline. That's not really what it's about. It's really just about speculating and making money on what direction the price is going to go in the future.
Okay, yeah, and you have a great explanation of this on page 156. And I'm not going to read the whole thing, but you say the impact of all this trading, both regulated and not, is to increase the demand for crude and to drive the price ever higher. And it's a great paragraph. So listeners, when you pick this book up, make sure you go to 156, the bottom of 156 and the top of page 157. Now, I do a radio program called Who's the Bad Guy? And I'd have to say that from reading your book, it seems like the two bad guys are married, Wendy and Phil Graham. Am I off base with that?
They're among the list for sure. So I guess we're sort of jumping around in history a bit, but basically what we had, to try and put this into one narrative, is the trading of oil futures and gasoline futures began in the 80s under Reagan. And the oil industry was very resistant to this type of futures trade because they really wanted to control the price of oil and gas themselves. But it became increasingly clear that they weren't going to be able to do that. So once the trading in futures began and it became very active, they decided, okay, if we can't beat them, we're going to join them. And if we're going to join them, we're going to control them. So if there's going to be trading in futures, we're going to control it as much as we can. And the way to do that was to say, we don't want the government overseeing any of this. We want to be able to be active in the futures market and use it in a way that best serves our interests. So we don't want the government telling us what to do. And through Wendy Graham and Phil Graham, the trading in oil futures was severely deregulated. And the government essentially removed itself from the process of regulating these trades. The most important deregulation happened under Phil Graham, and that was in 2000 when he really just snuck into a huge omnibus appropriations bill that was coming in at the tail end of the lame duck Clinton administration, a small provision into this 1,100-page bill that allowed for the complete deregulation of certain futures trading sites. And that included a trading site that was then set up by Enron immediately to conduct its own energy trades. And the result of which was the West Coast energy fiasco and Enron dramatically using its own exchange to completely manipulate the price of energy in the West Coast, which eventually helped bring down Enron altogether. But while Enron was brought down, its methods continued, including its energy traders, many of which who went to work for oil companies. And the method of setting up an independent exchange that wouldn't be regulated continued, and that became the Intercontinental Exchange. It's a foreign exchange based in Atlanta. Atlanta. It's become the primary place where oil futures are traded. And what you have is the New York Mercantile Exchange, which is heavily regulated by the U.S. government. The trades ran from there to the unregulated Intercontinental Exchange, where the majority of trades are happening. And as those trades started moving over to this unregulated exchange, thanks to the Grahams and what's forever now referred to as the Enron loophole, the price of oil went up and up and up and up and up because you had this rampant speculation that was feeding on itself and that was creating a false demand. We have no idea who was doing the trades, the size of the trades they were doing. Everything you try and control with regulation was out the door. And it's very similar to what was happening within the derivatives markets and what was happening with mortgages. Just no oversight, no sense of where one trade was connected to what trader, what they were doing, if they were manipulating the markets intentionally, and that sort of thing. Just a complete lack of oversight. And that run up in the price eventually, I believe, broke the global economy because we are so hardwired to the price of oil. Our entire economy is so hardwired that this dramatic and really unprecedented, dramatic run up in the price of oil going up to 2008 when it hit at the highest point it had ever hit at that point, I believe was the tipping point for the financial crisis because our global economies just couldn't handle it and the economy went into recession. So I actually think that the deregulation of oil markets was much more in many ways influential in causing the global financial crisis than other forms of deregulation were because, as I said, our economies just couldn't handle the speed with which the price increased and the height to which it increased. And the price has now basically settled at $100 a barrel, which is unbelievably high in the history of the price of oil. I think that the price of oil should be very high. It should probably be even higher than it is. But you have to help economies through the transition of that price, and you can't do it overnight. And all of the money and the benefits from that high price of oil, which I believe should be captured by governments and invested in ways to get us off of oil, are instead going into oil companies, banks, and hedge funds, which are using that money to continue the process that's already underway. So one of the reasons why we've also stayed, I think, in a global recession is that we've been stuck at this price of $100 a barrel of oil without any support to get us off of oil as rapidly as the price has risen. So this deregulation is a pretty fundamental and dramatic one. And yeah, the Grahams are right at the heart of it.
Oil today is up almost $2 a barrel to almost $107. And I've been watching it. It has been bouncing around in that area.
Price is up almost $10 from last year. I think we're really stuck at $100 a barrel of oil or more. And again, that's not high in terms of the costs associated with oil. But if you're going to have $100 a barrel of oil, you have to have the same type of commitment to lessening our dependence on that resource because our economy simply cannot afford $100 a barrel of oil. So we need to be doing other things that don't make us dependent on oil. And that means that governments have to be investing aggressively in public transit, alternative energy, cities that aren't dependent on people moving around in cars, restricting the methods that are used to get oil and instead reducing our consumption of energy overall. You know, all of these policies that are totally possible and, you know, all ready to go, but we just haven't invested in. And that's because the oil industry is capturing all of this money, and they're using it to lobby our governments to make it so that we can't implement those policies. And that's the cycle that has to be broken. We have to be capturing that money, and we have to be investing it, not the oil industry.
When we were talking about the Grahams, Phil and Wendy Graham, that was, of course, the Commodity Futures Modernization Act in December of 2000. You were talking about in the tail end of the Clinton administration. Of course, Clinton signed that without any hesitation, right?
I don't know if it was without any hesitation. It certainly had enormous resistance from within his own administration to that policy. I think Clinton was very much a president who was very interested in having a free hand for all corporations, including oil companies. I don't think he was as focused on the oil industry as the Bush administration certainly was after him. He had more, like his wife, just a sort of general free interest in corporations and what they do and where they want to go for all companies. No bias there towards the oil industry. And I think he just saw it as a continuation of those sort of policies. But there certainly was resistance within his administration. And my assumption is it wasn't just an easy decision to sign it, but sign it he did. I think it also made it much more difficult because it was within the omnibus appropriations bill and it was added at the very last minute and there were no hearings and there was no debate. The only resistance was, as I said, within the administration. I think at that point, the way that Graham introduced the amendment, it would have been very difficult not to sign the appropriation and therefore not to sign the Commodity Futures Modernization Act. It could have happened, but it would have been difficult.
You say here on page 128 that today, and of course this is back in 07, 08 when the book was being put together, but today the available supply surpasses demand. Is that still the case?
Yeah, we've been producing even significantly more. The policies that began during the Bush administration were continued by the Obama administration, such that we're producing more domestically of oil and gas than we have in decades, also internationally. So the Iraq war opened up an enormous spigot of oil in Iraq. Some people believe it's the largest source of oil in the world. At minimum, it's the third largest source of oil in the world. There was certainly production happening before the war, but there's much more production happening now. And you have companies like Exxon and BP and Shell and Chevron and all the companies that wanted to get into Iraq because of the war did get into Iraq because of the war. And so that's an enormous new pot of oil that's been brought online. There's tar sands production. There's offshore production. You know, the globe is booming in oil production at the same time that we're reducing our demands. So demand has been reduced in the United States, excuse me, not overall, but it certainly hasn't risen globally at the same pace that was anticipated. So you've got increased production, in many cases reduced demand, including in the United States, and yet increased price. And that clearly isn't how supply and demand is supposed to work. And that is clear evidence of manipulation of price.
Yeah, funny how that happens. Now, you mentioned before about the speculators, who they were, because I was going to address that on page 138. You say the speculators are basically banks, large corporations, and of course, as you said, the misnamed hedge funds, because hedge funds were originally created to, I believe, take a short position to protect against loss. And here the hedge funds are obviously, modern hedge funds are doing both. But if we look at the price of oil at the pump here, this is the key to it here, I guess. On page 133, you say that the price of oil, economists and analysts have determined that the price of oil has increased or is increasing between 20 and 50% because of the energy traders. And that's something that's known as the speculative premium. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
That's great. So if they weren't there, we'd be paying, let's say, instead of, well, here in New Jersey, we're at about $3.30, which is kind of low for the country. I know you guys out there on the West Coast are a lot higher than us.
Yeah.
I shouldn't be complaining, but we might be paying 50% less.
Well, there isn't a one-to-one relation between the price of oil and the price of gasoline. It's certainly the largest determinant, but it's not the only one. And there's a tremendous amount of concentration and consolidation within the domestic refining and selling of gasoline market that also adds to control of price. So I certainly believe that there's also manipulation happening at the level of the pricing of gasoline, so that what you'll often see is the price of oil will shoot up and the price of gasoline will follow it, but then the price of oil declines and the price of gasoline never follows it. And that means that there's also manipulation happening on the domestic side for the actual pricing of gasoline. That said, based on pure supply and demand and without speculation, I think you would certainly have lower prices for oil and lower prices of gasoline. Now, I say it that way because I'm not sure that that's a good thing. I think you want to have, again, high oil, high gasoline prices, but you want to make it possible for people to have other ways of getting around if they can't afford to drive their cars. And right now, we don't offer that. So when the price of gasoline is manipulated and pushed up and people have to pay $4 a gallon and they have no other choice but moving around in their car, and you have people literally choosing between eating breakfast in the morning and driving to work in the morning, that's hugely problematic and something that we can do something about. And we can address manipulation and we can address our investments, making it so that we lessen the control of this industry, not just through regulation and oversight, but also through giving ourselves many, many more alternatives to their product.
And that Enron loophole still exists today, and there's traders who are still manipulating it?
Yeah, unfortunately, there was a large push. It was one very good thing that Timothy Geithner has been trying to do and that the Obama administration did promise to take on, which was the Enron loophole. The problem is that the mechanism for fixing it, Dodd-Frank, that legislation has just been utterly lost in a morass of lobbying and lawsuits by the financial sector, by the oil sector, by lobbyists from all stripes, stopping actually very good piece of legislation from being able to take effect, and a Republican-controlled Congress that has allowed that to happen. And that is, you know, just terrible. It's actually a good piece of legislation that would address many of the problems we're talking about, many of the problems of the cause of global financial crisis, which has not been implemented. And that's not because the Obama administration hasn't tried. It's because it's literally been, you know, I sort of imagine these like series of ropes and rubber bands tying up the capacity of the government to actually do something that we've tasked them to do because of lobbyists and because of the Congress.
Yeah. Now, finally, I wanted to address address this because I've always been fascinated with this topic. On page 153, you talk about the mainstream media, the pundits scoffing at the protesters, and Washington Post columnist Charles Krauthammer writing that, and of course we're talking about the California electricity market, which you mentioned earlier, the manipulation in it. Oh no, there's no manipulation, there's a conspiracy, you guys are nuts. And you say here, as prices rose and the protests continued, the press dug deeper. Besides the press having a bad relationship, an incestuous relationship with corporations, why is it that the press should dig in deeper to defend the corporations? Why shouldn't they be defending us?
The way that that sentence is meant to read in the book is that public protest then drove the press to actually do its job, which they then did. And it worked. The public resisted. The public kept protesting. The public kept raising the question, forcing the hand of the press to actually do its job. And then the press did do its job. And I think it's like anything, when you balance out the constant pressure that is put on the media to do good by its funders. You know, I live in the Bay Area. Chevron is the largest company. It's the second largest oil corporation, but it's also by far the largest corporation in our state and the most powerful one. And Chevron is also the largest advertiser in many media outlets. And they are certainly resistant to reporting on a company that gives them lots of money in advertising. And there's many ways in which those restraints are played out. But when there's a true public demand for information, you will see the press have to break away from that. And I think you saw that, and you see that play out regularly. And I think at the same time, there are journalists that really want to be free to do their job and need that public pressure on their news outlets for them to be able to go to their editor and say, you know, screw BP right now. I need to do this story and the public wants it and they're going to buy our papers if we do it. And then that does happen. So, you know, you can see it as a way of the public helping out journalists by saying, we want this story. We need to hear it, and then actually supporting those outlets when they get those stories. It does work. It can work. But the media needs to hear from the public for the stories that it actually wants to hear. Sometimes that chain does work. It certainly did work in the case of Enron. It took persistent public protests saying, no, we know this is manipulation, to get past the Bush administration, which was refusing to investigate, the media, which was being lackadaisical, to actually push the hand of the press, and then the press responded.
And this guy Krauthammer is still on television.
He's not a journalist. He's a right-wing talking head.
Ideologue, yeah, talking head. Yeah. Right, okay.
He's not a journalist.
Oh, God.
Just correct that.
You know, you're a fantastic journalist, fantastic investigative reporter, educating people about the truth, which is why I was so excited about talking to you. Once I dug into your book, I said, my God, this is beautiful. She's great. I love it. I can't wait to talk to her. I wish there were more people like her out there. But the Charles Krauthammers of the world seem to get unfortunately, the talking head status, where they're right there in front of everybody. You should be out there in front of everybody.
Well, thank you. I appreciate your close reading of the book. It's a pleasure to talk about it. And, you know, also why we went longer than we intended, as I enjoyed your questions. So I hope we had a good dialogue for your listeners. I really appreciate the questions and the time that you gave me.
Well, thank you. One last question then. Where are we going here with the price of oil and big oil? What does your average American have in store for them at the pump?
The oil industry couldn't be stronger in many ways. It's got enormous sources of oil and natural gas being made available to it, and it has been able to maintain this control of price of both oil and gas. I don't see those prices lessening, but there is good resistance. So I do think the public is increasingly aware of the power of the fossil fuel industry and deeply desirous to lessen that influence. And you see a big pushback on things like the Keystone Pipeline, a huge pushback on fracking and tar sands production. I do think that it was public pressure that led to putting in place an administration that was committed to ending the war in Iraq, and the war in Iraq is over. Hopefully, the war in Afghanistan is actually going to be ended in 2014 as it was promised. And it was the public desire to not see us continue down the path of more wars and to end the wars that we were in, which has succeeded, and to say we're not willing to go to any length to get oil. And I think that position is winning ground, and certainly public awareness on climate has led to an enormous amount of activism. 350.org has a wonderful campaign on divestment, for example, for cities and public universities to divest holdings from the fossil fuel industry. That's the type of dialogue we need to be having. And so I'm positive about what the public is interested in. I'm positive about the fact that we don't have a continuation of the Bush administration in office. And I'm hopeful that we'll continue to see that it's in our best interest to, while we are dependent on oil, which we are, to constrain those that purvey it for us and to embrace the alternatives.
Antonia Yuhas, the author of The Tyranny of Oil, The World's Most Powerful Industry and What We Must Do to Stop It, and the author of two other books. I want to thank you so much for the time you took explaining all this to the listeners. I had a thoroughly enjoyable time reading your book and listening to you explain it, and I'm very much looking forward to speaking to you in the future.
Well, thanks very much for having me. I appreciate it.